Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Alex McKeithen, and he is the author of a new book. It's a memoir. It's called The Seventh Angel. Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
It's called The Seventh Angel.
That's right, Seventh Angel.
Where'd that come from?
I hit a bit of mania, and I was reading Revelation one night, and the last night when I was very, very high, and not on anything, on any drugs or anything. It was a natural high. And
you were just very happy. You were very happy.
I was extremely happy. I had gotten very elevated throughout the summer in Tuscany. I went there with the University of Georgia to paint. And it was the summer of the Joshua Tree, which is U2's number one album of all time. Probably the best album of all time.
You still feel that way?
I have a new favorite group, the Eels.
And all right, but back then you were, as a part of a high that you just thought you were in the most happy times. You didn't know anything was going on in terms of your mental condition or anything. You were just very happy.
Well, I thought that something special was happening with me in Tuscany that summer. There were a couple of times I thought my paintings were going to be maybe masterpieces, which was totally kind of over the top, except for my painting teacher was kind of backing me up in that belief. Well, maybe they are better than Van Gogh, but I look at them now. I was in Blowing Rock this weekend. My parents have a couple of paintings in their house there, and they're not better than Van Gogh. A few of them are pretty good.
Yeah. All right. So you're feeling good, and you're reading the book of the Bible in the book the last book in
well,
the Bible.
I would say just before we go to the reading of the Revelation, there were a couple of times in Tuscany in the small town called Cortona, where I was searching for an answer for how I was special, what was going on with me, and I closed my eyes and said a prayer and opened my eyes, asking God for an answer. To show me a sign, and I opened my eyes, and there was a dove flying in front of me, and I thought that was just an amazing coincidence, or not even a coincidence, but some sort of indication
of a prayer answer. What we all look for is answered prayer, and you got an answer.
It was, and then a week later, I did the same thing, and the exact same thing happened. Now, I like to say that it was a dove, but I don't know the difference between a white pigeon and a dove. So if anyone out there knows about the bone structure of birds or anything, you can, educate me. I'm doing some more readings. We'll be in, I don't know when this is going to air, but we will... I would like input as to what the difference between a dove and a pigeon is.
Okay. Well, yeah. All right. So, but your prayer's been answered.
Right.
Which is essentially confirmation that you were someone special.
Right. And then when I got to Paris, I was very elevated, bordering on, it was hypomania. And I really thought that I was special, but without... knowing exactly what the purpose was or what my role was going to be with God and the religion. And we were just talking about the reading of the Revelation. I went to a movie that night with some friends that I had recently met. I was bordering... boarder with two young girls, 19 and 17. I was 21. This whole incident was 25 years ago.
You're in Paris. You're going to be an exchange student, or
right.
You're your junior year abroad student, and
right.
And so you with the people with whom you're staying, where you're boarding,
right.
You're going to a movie.
Their parents were divorced, so the father wasn't around, and the mother was an archaeologist, and she was on a dig far away. So I had the perfect setup to be living with these two pretty girls and they had pretty friends and, you know, nice guys. And one of the guys, he wanted to play baseball. And I just, it was hilarious going to a baseball game in Paris. They were terrible. I mean, it was like any hit out of the infield would be a triple because it was just, the fielding was horrendous. And they would say, vazi, vazi, which means go, 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 you know, like, so it was a funny, he was a postal worker. He lived in the slums outside of Paris, and it was really nice to see how he overcame such a hard situation. It probably, you know, made me feel even more, I don't know what to say about how that made me feel, but I really, it lifted me up to see that this guy lives in the slums outside of Paris. I entered his room, and I know we're getting off topic a little bit, but when I entered his room, he had a whole wall dedicated to Ozzie Smith, who was a baseball player for, I think, the Padres and then the Cardinals. And Ozzie Smith was famous for doing backflips during games, and I just love that. He got total he had a totally great and optimistic outlook on life, and a lot of it came from American baseball there in, you know, soccer country.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Reading the Revelations the last night, we did this group of us, Joss, who was the postal worker, and the two girls that I lived with, Alex and Orion, and another guy, they went to a movie on the Champs-Élysées. And the night before, and the movie was The Witches of Eastwick. And I thought that I was too pure to go to a movie about witches with witches in it. So I gave all my money to a homeless person, and then I didn't have any money to get home. So I walked about.
How'd you explain your feeling about witches and your own, and that you were special and pure to these normal French people who liked you, and they must have thought you were kind of strange when you kind of walked away from the movie.
Well, I wasn't really proselytizing to anybody. I saved that all for the pastors and the priests.
For the next day that you're going to tell us about
it
in a minute.
For the next day, right.
So you went home and started reading the Bible.
Went home and started, walked all the way home and started reading Revelation. And
any reason you turned to that book at that time? That you can remember.
Well, during the summer, like I said, I was listening to Joshua Tree, and it's messianic and really it's melodic, messianic, seems like it has a lot to do with Revelation. And the lyrics, I thought they were meant just for me. They were, I see seven towers, but I only see one way out. And I looked out over Paris from the top of an art museum there, the Pompidou Center, and I saw seven towers. So this stuff was real. And there will come a day when the colors will bleed into one. And it seemed like those were some more lyrics from a different song. And they just seemed so apocalyptic, and they seemed to fit with Revelation. And when I read Revelation, I got to the seventh angel, and there were four angels that were kind of working with this seventh angel or at the same point in the book. And I just knew that was Bono and Adam Clayton and the rest of rest
but the
of
angels
U2.
were this group that you were.
It was U2.
Yeah,
they were holding back the corners of the earth, you know, until the time comes. You know, the apocalypse.
Well, in terms of your religious background, does this fit with your training as a, you know, growing up training and your training, what you learned about the Bible and religion in college?
I grew up in the church in a family that is a church-going family, and religion is, as you know, it's very serious in the Bible Belt. And I my family's in the Bible Belt. They grew up in the church and are believers. And I went to Sunday school my whole life and had strong beliefs about it. So I was definitely primed for that to play a heavy influence for the church to, you know, be very important in the this decision-making, not decision-making, but influenced me towards the move towards incorporating religion into the mania.
So we're going to take a quick break. We're visiting with Alex McKeithen about his new book, The Seventh Angel. It's a memoir, and he's given us an insight into the story about where the seventh angel came from, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Alex McKeithen, and we're talking about his book, The Seventh Angel. Alex's book opens with a scene in Paris, and he's given us the background. He was a junior year abroad student in Paris, and you told us about your encounter with Revelations, reading it after a season where you were really feeling, as you say, high. You were feeling good about yourself, and you were feeling called.
It was the most wonderful that time of my life.
God was identifying you as somebody special, and that you so you're now at night reading this Bible.
And highlighting the entire book of Revelation. Everything except for ands and these and buts were highlighted. It was all important at that time. It was the whole book was yellow when I was
from your reading just in one night. You're just reading it over and over again. And although every important word was highlighted, what were the what were the words that really stuck out to you or that meant something to you? And
I really can't really say if I have to think about that one for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what happened next?
Well, next I seized on the idea that I was the seventh angel, and influenced by that, or what made me kind of think that was, as I said a minute ago, the four angels that came at about the same time were, to me, they were U2 with, you know, Bono and the rest of the group. And it's very hard to describe what happened to me when I woke up. The alarm sounded, and I looked at the clock, and I saw the red digital 6. And I equated the 6, the red digital 6, with the sound of the alarm clock. And then I turned away from the clock, and I heard another sound. So the sound had equaled 6 for me. And when I heard the second sound, it was another 6 because the sound equaled the 6. And then the third buzz of the alarm clock was the 666, which is, as a lot of people know, the sign of the devil. And the Bible says that the person who figures out the riddle of the 666 will have to be very clever. And of course, I thought I was extremely clever. So that was the moment when I knew that Revelation was there, was here, and I was waking up to it at sometime around 6 o'clock in the morning. I called my father. I had
Now you're in Paris. Your father's in Charlotte.
My father's in Charlotte. So I called my dad right away. My dad's an attorney, and I had
now this is it's 6 o'clock in the morning in Paris, so it's in the middle of the night, I guess. In
that's
Charlotte.
Right. It's probably 12 o'clock and something like that. And I was worried about him because he's. You know, lawyers can be serious and kind of a. I called these lawyers and businessmen and bankers tie men, and DG's wearing a tie right now, so he's not a tie man though. There's some tie men who can escape the escape.
No, Alex, I'm a tie man. I mean, it's just I'm right there. But I'm with you now. You're in Paris. You're getting ready to begin your junior year,
right?
And you're getting all of these signs that you are something special. Now, how does that translate into doing something?
The triple six just really set me off. I was just like a cannon. I was shot out of a cannon, and I took all the money I had, and the guys had slept over in the room next to mine, and they were sleeping, and I woke them up, and I just told them, you know, in French, that it was the last day, and they needed to be ready. And they saw me with the money in both holding the money in both hands, ready to rip it up. And they were like, no, don't rip up the money.
But you did.
And they said, if you don't want it, we'll take it. And I said, no one needs money. This is the final day of the earth. And eventually it led me to the belief that since it's the final day, no one needs clothing. And pushed me to the point of going to different churches to alert pastors that it was the final day, that it was the apocalypse. I wanted to go to as many churches as possible. Every church I went to, they turned me away. They told me I was crazy. They didn't want to hear it. It wasn't convenient for them. But if you think about it, it's convenient for them to think that it's just going to happen sometime in the more distant future rather than in their own present. So the long story short on that one is I ended up taking all my clothes off.
Now, you didn't take them off all at once?
No. I went to different churches. I saw a homeless man. I gave him a jacket. I took off socks, and at that point, I didn't like man-made machines that made a lot of noise that wrecked my moment in the beauty of the world, you know. And there in beautiful Paris, there's a plane high above, and so many people have to listen to it, and it wrecks their, you know, if you think of like the Garden of Eden, there were no airplanes or cars or motorcycles, and that's was my the moment. That was how I was reasoning at that time. Was this could be a second Garden of Eden? Maybe we're headed towards that with the apocalypse. Maybe the apocalypse is going to wipe the slate clean, and people are no longer going to be ashamed of their bodies.
You didn't have the precise idea about what was going to happen, but you knew something was going to happen, and you were charged with letting people know. When you went to the church and told the pastor, the end of the world is here, and I'm the seventh angel, what did you expect or want them to? What would have been the right response to you in that moment of, I don't want to say craziness, but of certainty that you were delivering a message? What's the right response other than, hey, buddy, you're crazy, get out of here?
That's a question I have not even ever thought about. I guess I wanted, I don't know what I wanted them to do. I guess I would want them to, like, pray or contact other people and tell them that it's the last day of the earth and it's time to be ready and everyone needs to repent. And, you know, I guess that's what I wanted.
It was like, I mean, this is the message, repent, the end of the earth is at hand, so get yourself in order.
That's right. Exactly. And I didn't know what, you know, get yourself in order meant, but I knew I was getting myself in order. And my getting myself in order meant taking my jeans off and leaving them at one altar, running with only a white T-shirt on and briefs, not even the long boxers, but
briefs. What are you thinking about your – all right, so you've given away – almost all of your clothes, and here you are with your undershirt and underwear.
Right.
And so are you anxious to now get rid of that as well? How's that going?
It wasn't going well at all. It was very It was terrible running, even just in briefs.
And were people in Paris looking at you? Or are they so used to weird people that they just ignore you? And
well, that to go back in the interview right here, it was really funny that I had moved in with these two girls, and the boarder they had from the year before was a Californian, and that's why they didn't.
They thought nothing of your weirdness.
Oh, he must have been, you know, really a true Californian and a totally free spirit. And for me, for them to see me, you know, writing poetry all night long, which is what bipolar people stay up late at night. They don't need much sleep. I was sleeping maybe an hour and a half, you know, for a week and a half before the incident. But I thought it was really funny that the guy from California messed things up for me.
You mean otherwise they might have sensed better that you were not just on a high, but that you were moving towards a bipolar craziness sort of thing.
I think the problem with the situation there was that I was, you know, already 21 and they were 19 and 17. So they were, and it was, you know, like they weren't going to, it might have helped if they hadn't had the border from California. I think that's true. Yeah.
It would have blown the whistle on you. All right. Well, now I've interrupted you because right now you're in downtown Paris alone by yourself.
Right.
And you're running along looking for another church, and you've got your underwear on.
Yes.
And people are beginning to notice you, I guess. Maybe you didn't notice that, but they're beginning
to. There was a little bit of time when I was allowed just to run without anyone noticing, or, you know, not that I remember. And I think it really came to people's attention when the shirt came off and then the underwear came off.
How did you come to the, I mean, there would be some, if you had a moment of you know, modesty of saying, you know, this is not
definitely
really what. Well, how did that decision go?
That decision was weighed back and forth and back and forth over and over, and it was a struggle with God to let me to let the purity of whiteness, the white T-shirt and the white briefs, be good enough for God, but.
Are you having a conversation with God, or are you just looking for a sign from God about not having to do this?
Well, I never had any so-called conversations. You know, there was never anything where I felt like I was talking with God, none of that. There were no voices or anything that I heard, or, you know, me just saying prayers, or, you know, like, oh, I'm really just talking to myself and knowing that God is a part of this event. And that I came, you know, after struggling with the idea. Well, one thing that helped was I rounded the corner of a street and looked at the top of the street, and there was the Arc de Triomphe. And that was like a really big boost for me to go ahead. That was saying to me, this is the goal, this is the mission. You're going to go to the Arc de Triomphe, and this struggle with, you know, is white pure enough, or do I need to, you know, go to nudity? And the things that won out for nudity were the fact that this was not any day. It was the very special last day, you know, so there's no clothes on that last day.
Did you toss your clothes before you got to the Arc de Triomphe, or as you got there?
I took the clothes off, and I probably ran a half a mile with no clothes on. Wow.
We're going to take a quick break and find out what happened next.
Okay.
We're talking to with Alex McKeithen about his book, The Seventh Angel. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Alex McKeithen and I are talking about his new book, of the Seventh Angel. He's as he describes in the book and as described to us, he's in Paris. He thinks he's the seventh angel from the book of Revelations, announcing to the world that the
My mother would be quick to point out that it's not Revelations.
It's Revelation. It's Apocalypse in the French version of the Bible.
Okay. But I thought it was funny. I kept writing Revelations, and she was getting
corrected you because yes, she's a Bible scholar. Well, yeah. I'm sorry to do this. But you're running towards, right, when we took the break, you're running towards the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. You're a college student, for anybody who joined us late, and you you think you're the seventh angel, and you're running towards the Arc de Triomphe.
Right.
You don't have any clothes on.
No clothes
now,
on.
Now, do people in Paris start noticing you now, do you think?
They did, and it was cold, yes.
It was a cold day.
There was shrinkage.
well, what happened next? What happened?
I hate to say that, but that's one of the things that I've been doing some readings around the state at UNCW and Wilmington, East Carolina. And,
that's the line that gets the attention?
They like that one. Yeah, the college right. students like that one. Also, I took off the jeans, I've written in the book my 32-inch waist Levi bootcut jeans, and they like it when I point out that they're no longer the jeans I wear now are no longer 32 inches.
Yeah, we're getting moving towards middle age. But yeah. We're reflecting on this moment, and I'm curious as I can be, so I'm trying to push you to tell us what happens as you're running towards the Arc de Triomphe.
I started noticing people looking at me, large groups. Large group of American women, I could tell.
And are you shouting the world is...
I wasn't doing anything like that. I was just focusing on... I had written a lot of poetry in the week and a half leading up to that. I was carrying that. I was probably carrying a Bible or... And I knew that the place for me to leave these things was... There's a tomb of the unknown soldier at kind of... just at the base in front of the arc, and everything was coming to me as it happened. I didn't have any plan. I was just putting things together as I went along. There were a lot of people talking about me, people looking at me, and I realized then that there wasn't just the arc, but there's the roundabout, and it's a roundabout.
A lot of traffic
roundabout. It's 10 lanes. It's pure chaos, and it's not a good. Everyone who goes to the arc gets to the arc through an underground passageway.
But you didn't take that way. You took the above ground.
I took the high road.
Did you get bumped by any cars?
I had cars that I had to put my hands on their hood that nearly, I jumped over the hood kind of.
And are these drivers cussing you in French or are they?
I just looked at their faces and they weren't doing anything other than trying to stop in time not to hit me or it was a mad dash of.
All right, so you get to, but you ultimately get there safely.
I made it across and was very happy about that. But then there's, when you're naked in the middle of the Arc de Triomphe, you can't stop and celebrate that you made it across, didn't get hit. You can be happy about it, but you can't stop. Uh-huh. You have to, I took everything I was carrying and leaned over the rope that cordons off the tomb of the unknown soldier and put all my things there and all my poetry and all my things that had meant so much to me.
And what was your thinking? For what purpose?
I thought that was like an offering on the day of the apocalypse, that it was everything that I had written that was pure and that I had really, that was one of the roles
I'm
of the
giving all
angel.
That I have. Is that sort of, and I'm giving it up because it's the day of the apocalypse or right. this is an offering to God or to, this is.
I thought that it was just part of the process of the final day and that it was something I was just supposed to do. And then I realized that I'm at this world top attraction in the world, and I'm naked, and I can't, no time to tarry, I say in the book. And I begin to run out through the arch and out the backside, and guards start chasing me.
So you're getting ready to cross out over this traffic circle again? You're going to run out into traffic?
Right, and with guards chasing and cars. There were two pedestrian blockades in front of me. I jumped the first one cleanly, and the second one I didn't make it over, and I tumbled into the first lane of cars coming at my back, and that's really scary. That was really scary.
So, you really could have been run over.
It was really getting really dicey at that point. And I was really thinking there's no way I can get out of this and make it home without any clothes on. And then wham, guard tackled me from behind down into the street. We I don't know if we stay in the first lane or the second, or but neither of us got hit. And I was just so happy. That,
what do you mean happy? You're happy that they stopped you?
I was ecstatic that I didn't have to get killed by a car. And it happened over and over that day that I acted like I wanted to do something, run with the cars coming at me from behind and get away. But I didn't really want that. I wanted to get tackled.
You wanted to be stopped?
Yes. I wanted to be stopped from myself killing myself, I was heading in that direction pretty quickly.
Well, you're now in confinement, and let's take a break and talk about what happened after all of this. We're visiting with Alex McKeithen about his book, The Seventh Angel. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Alex McKeithen is my guest. He's the author of The Seventh Angel. It's a memoir about his time in Paris when he experienced incredible highs and then crashed in the middle. I guess is what do you call this? When you began to examine this with your doctors and what did you call this?
A manic episode.
A manic episode.
Right, through the roof.
Let me just say, we've only got a little bit of time to talk about it, and there's so much to talk about after the excitement of talking about this episode, which was incredible when you were the seventh angel, at least in your own mind. And then all of a sudden, the episode is over. You're confined in a mental hospital in Paris.
Yes.
Other than just time passing. In your book, you described that your real help came at Duke.
That's right.
Can you tell us? Can you tell us about what it was that? Curing is not the right word, but what was it that happened in terms of your evaluation, treatment, and experience at Duke that brought you back into the world?
I had a great doctor there. He immediately diagnosed it as it was manic depression, and the terms were switching from manic depression to bipolar at that right then.
So is this the same thing?
It is the same thing.
And are there new terms that we use to describe this, or we still use bipolar and manic?
Bipolar is the correct term.
Is the correct term. This is a doctor, since you told me about him, is a very highly respected doctor, David Jones, I guess, is his name. And he's got lots of friends here in Chapel Hill who will be glad to know that he was important to you in your recovery. But at first, you didn't take – you were – I mean, it wasn't an immediate liking of him, because he had some hard work for you to do, I guess.
I had to come off of the medication that was a mismanaged or wrong medication that I was on in France.
Do you know what it was? Did they tell you?
It was Haldol.
And that was that was what they thought was the right, but it was the wrong?
Haldol is an antipsychotic, so that for that purpose, it would be kind of the right thing. But if you're allergic to it,
it was right for the condition, but wrong for you because you had some special reaction to this.
Yeah, I couldn't sit in a chair for more than 12 or 15 seconds for an entire month. I couldn't fall asleep until I was dead tired.
And this was not the manic.
No, this was a side effect of
a medicine that was dealing with your mental condition.
That's right.
But it was creating something that arguably was worse.
Right. I ran into a psychiatrist. It was called the Maison Blanche, which she thought was funny because that means White House in English.
This is the French mental institution.
The French. I would call it an asylum. It was on par with Cuckoo's Nest. It was very, very far out kind of crazy kind of situation in people. We had pacers. We had people who banged their head into the wall for periods of time.
I tell you what, I'm just going to this is a very important part of your book and your experience, and I hate to move you on it, but I want to close with the hopefulness that was created in terms of your experience at Duke. And it wasn't like it's it wasn't like it's an easy experience, but the thing that's exciting to me about your book is that as a result of that, you came out pretty much a whole person. I mean, and with a way to live the rest of your life in a positive and upbeat way.
I was at Duke for 4 months, so it had a long time to heal and for my brain to come back together. And I really, with the book, one of the main things I want to do is show people that people who have bipolar are not kooky and crazy, and there are a lot of misrepresentations and movies. I don't want to mention the Silver Linings, but books and TV shows. And every time I see bipolar portrayed, it's they portray it in a kooky, corny kind of what do you call it? Negative kind of stereotypical way. And I really want these kids at these universities and people older than the and whatever age to see that someone can be normal and be bipolar. And also, I want people to read the book and recognize some of the symptoms. And if I had read the book, I think maybe I would have been much more likely to go to a doctor and cap it before it. Because if it goes through the roof, your episode.
Is it your feeling from what you've learned about your condition that it is better to prevent the kind of manic episode that you had rather than let it explode? Because there's something that
I have a meeting, not a meeting, but an event with Duke doctors in a couple of days, and I'm going to ask them.
You're going to ask them that question,
yeah, because I keep saying that if you cap it before you go through the roof, then it's going to be a lot easier to heal.
You're going to ask that question to the experts rather than trying to answer it for me now.
I think that's the answer. Yeah.
Well, look, the other thing that I think is puzzling to me. Challenging for me is we've talked about the down experience of what happens with this crash, but you talked earlier about being very happy before the crash.
It was the best time of my life. It was really wonderful. I was ecstatic, and it was so much fun, and I'll never feel that good again.
So that is it a warning sign? If we get to be too happy in our lives, is that something we should ought to be worried about? That might indicate that there's an approaching manic episode in our lives.
I think if you start feeling that you're special somehow, other than just being a normal human being, then
watch
you're in
out.
Trouble.
Then yeah. Watch out.
If you start thinking thoughts like that, you're heading out of bounds.
You said it was the happiest time of your life. You wouldn't trade it?
I wouldn't trade it because...
Now, wait a minute. I'm asking you, if you went through this horrible recovery and healing experience,
right?
If you could trade this happy time and turn that in and not have had to go through this terrible healing experience and then spend the rest of your life sort of managing that, would you trade it?
I wouldn't trade it at all. I mean, even... the fact of the painfulness of the Maison Blanche and
this
and
is Duke, the French and, insane asylum
right, and Duke was really it was so hard to wake up at 8 a.m. and have nothing to do all day every day, but no, I wouldn't trade it because I would never know the potential amount of happiness that I could reach.
Would you do it again?
No. I've had my one ride.
Once in a lifetime.
That's it, yeah. It's interesting to have been in a mental asylum in France. These are experiences that most people don't get to have. And, I kind of enjoy it gave me the chance to write this book.
Yeah. So you celebrate this abnormal experience in your life because it gives you the chance to write something, and it's a terribly good book.
I appreciate it. I had a great time writing it. And
there's so much more to talk about Alex McKeithen, okay. But I just have to tell people, you're going to have to read the book.
Yeah,
it's called The Seventh Angel. It's a memoir by Alex McKeithen, who's been our guest and shared a lot of it with us, for which we thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.